Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mike Krieger, co-founder of the photo sharing app Instagram. Instagram was released through Apple's App Store in October 2010 and reached 1 million users in just 3 months. Facebook acquired Instagram in 2012 for $1 billion. Mike and his partner Kevin Systrom are both graduates of Stanford University. Mike graduated in 2008. He is originally from Sao Paulo, Brazil. Welcome.
Thank you.
I want to start with a project that you worked on when you were a student at Stanford. It was a photo sharing project, coincidentally, and it elegantly foreshadows what you developed with Instagram. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I was taking this class with BJ Fogg as a professor there, and the purpose of the class was try to create behavior change through technology. And one of the things we got interested in was seasonal affective disorder. My sister was going to school at Chicago, and you know, moving from Sao Paulo, which is not the sunniest city in the world, but it's pretty sunny, to Chicago with its pretty dreary winters was a tough adjustment for her. And I'd gotten her one of those lamps that you can, you know, get you ionizes the air and gives you some good ambient light. But we made this app. It was called Send the Sunshine. It's kind of a proto Instagram, and the idea was people who were in, you know, since the hemispheres divide summer and winter, if you're in summer very sunny, you could hopefully send some sunshine through images to friends that might be on the other, or friends or strangers on the other side of the world. And we built it. This was pre-iPhone, so my prototype was made on a Nokia, like the beginning of the smartphone, but it had a camera, and that was enough to prototype the idea.
Did you have any sense that, oh yeah, this is photo sharing is something that resonates with me, and I'm going to put this in my back pocket for later, or is it just one of those random coincidences?
I think there was that theme throughout a lot of the projects I worked on. Another one, I was there when the iPhone got released and started taking off, and that was the first year that they had the iPhone programming course at Stanford, and you had to do a final project, and mine was this postcard sending app where you would send photos to each other. You would record an audio message, and the other receiver, you would have to shake it to like reveal the photo that you had been sent. I don't think it was a conscious process, but in looking back, you can definitely draw the line from a lot of projects that both me and Kevin were working on, and we kind of came together at the intersection of a lot of our interests.
You and Kevin, though, the project that you started out with looks a lot different from the project you ended up with. The project you started out with was a company called Bourbon. It was really Kevin's project initially. It was kind of like a Foursquare knockoff. It was a location-based app. Can you talk about how you just jettisoned that and started on Instagram?
Yeah, and the very first day I got to, you know, I left my job, I was going to go work with Kevin, and we show up, you know, the office the first day, we go for a walk in South Park, which is this nice little French-style neighborhood in San Francisco, and Kevin was like, I think we should abandon Bourbon. That was the first day of, like, I just left my job, what are we doing? And the feeling in my stomach was a really familiar one. It was the feeling I had when trying to work on my master's thesis at Stanford and not knowing what the project was. You know, we struggled for a while to find how to make Bourbon appeal to people, and the instinct we had was just add more stuff. Which is really normal. You know, it's like, I'll change for you, I'll do more. But actually, the real change was getting rid of 99% of it and just keeping the raw elements of it. But really, it took a long time for us to build sort of the courage or the conviction that it was time to, you know, jettison a lot of it and move sideways.
So you stripped down everything and you landed with just the photo. And Bourbon, before that, the photo was an aside.
Yeah.
So how did you come to that?
It was literally an attachment in the Bourbon case. And even though Bourbon was a mess and it had a lot of different features that we kept adding, the one thing people kept coming back to was the photo sharing piece. There's a screenshot of Bourbon that I like showing every new employee to show kind of like the origin story. And it's one where my then girlfriend, now wife, Caitlin, was in Minneapolis. She used to do a lot of work for Target. And it was my way of seeing what she was up to when she traveled. And that connection, there was something there. Like Kevin likes to say, is there a there? Very early, and we said, all right, like, why don't we just take that part, which we love and people are doing, even though it's really hard to do in Bourbon, mm-hmm. and make it so easy that people want to do it every day.
Also, another decision that was made, even unconsciously, was making it solely an app and focusing on it for a mobile device versus building it for the web. Tell me about that.
2010, most of the photos you would see were ones that had been produced days ago, if not weeks ago, and then uploaded later when you'd like finally found that camera cable and synced it to your computer. We wanted to make things feel instantaneous and for you to really know what was going on right now or today even, rather than a week ago. So that was a lot of where the desire to go mobile first and really stick with it. And to this day, we don't allow you to upload from the web. We could get more photos on Instagram that way, but I don't think they would be the right photos.
Your partner, Kevin Systrom, he has called you the soul of Instagram. And I was thinking, I'd like to be called the soul of something. It says a lot about your relationship with him. And you kind of came together through happenstance. I mean, you were both part of the Stanford culture, but you came together accidentally almost. How did that happen?
Yeah, the way was very much on the weekends going to coffee shops in San Francisco. This was before the kind of tech boom in the last 4 or 5 years, so that wasn't a completely obvious thing to do. You know, most people in the coffee shops were not working on tech at the time. And once you see somebody enough times and you have some kind of connection, we struck up a conversation and he showed me Bourbon, and it was the first kind of new app that I'd gotten excited about in a really long time.
He was working on Bourbon, but prior to that, he was an intern at Odeo, which became Twitter and Google, and then a startup, Next Stop, which was sold to Facebook. So he was really in, you know, with the right people. And in a way, I feel like your story is one of knowing the right people. Even though I appreciate what Instagram is, I don't think you can downplay just the importance of having the right bedfellows with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think since, you know, we've grown there have been articles that have tried to look at, you know, how much of this is the Stanford connection? Where do you meet people through there? And there's definitely something to it. I remember in college, we both, Kevin and I, though in different years, were Mayfield Fellows, which is this entrepreneurship program where there's 12 of us a year. You do 3 months of case studies, 3 months of an internship at a startup that you choose. Well, not you choose, you have to get a job there. And then 3 months of debriefs. And in the case study section, we'd be studying a, you know, case about Steve Blank, and then Steve Blank would be in the class talking to you. And that is very, very hard to replicate, even in any kind of sort of scalable way, but was something we were really lucky to have.
In the early days, you had some trouble just personally in acquiring a visa. You're from Brazil, and you did not have your H-1B visa.
Yeah, this is the biggest, scariest thing in making the leap. I knew I wanted to do a startup at some point, and I knew I wanted to do something soon, but actually getting the visa, proving to the government that this new enterprise that we were trying to get off the ground was legitimate and had the ability to pay my salary, which is an important requirement of that, of the visa process, took about 3 to 4 months, which, you know, when you're ready to make that leap was pretty painful, because we're like, we want to get started. I want to get working on this. I have all these ideas. But we were very much in the hands of waiting for the government decision.
Ultimately, you did get your visa. And you mentioned before that, you know, you had kind of photo sharing experience, but Kevin also had his own photo experience. I think he was like photo editor of his high school newspaper or something. And he went to Florence, Italy for a semester at Stanford and, you know, held a Holga camera, which makes square pictures. But his girlfriend, Nicole, had influence on him. Can you tell us how?
Yeah, I think for when we were really starting to work on the product, which became Instagram, the feedback from Nicole was, oh, this seems like a neat product, but I'm not going to use it because I don't think my photos look very good. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of an interesting little core moment. You can break down actually two really important pieces of influence that Caitlin and Nicole, our respective partners, had. One was Nicole kind of saying like, if the photos don't look good, I'm not going to share them. And the other one was Caitlin actually helped us turn around the Bourbon concept into Instagram. She went somewhere and she said, like, I want to share a photo of where I am, but I don't want to tell you where I am. And Bourbon was location first, then photo. And that helped us flip it and say, why don't we lead with the photo? You can optionally add a location, but that shouldn't be required.
It's interesting. I don't take pictures on Instagram, but I'm a voyeur and I follow some of my friends. It's striking how much more interesting their life is than mine. But, you know, I think about kind of like the changing social dynamic in a way that Instagram has catalyzed. I used to, after college, I don't know why, I was obsessed with like making a movie called Publicly Private, which made public all those private things that people did. Because you think you're doing something private, but really everybody around you is doing the same private thing.
Right.
And I feel like Instagram has unleashed that kind of, even though it's, as you said, it's well edited.
Or noticing that people who live very public lives have, you know, private moments that are, you know, what am I saying? Like, they're just like one of us. I remember Lena Dunham, it was the morning after maybe the Golden Globes. I can't remember what awards show, but she shared a photo she had just won. She was, like, in her hotel room just waking up and seeing it. So it's, like, yeah, bringing people into that in a way that, like, I think feels more controlled than, like, mm-hmm. you know, like a paparazzi's camera. It's something that's very sort of in the person's hands.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mike Krieger, co-founder of Instagram, the photo sharing app acquired by Facebook in 2012. Facebook acquired Instagram 1.5 years after launch when the company had 30 million users. I don't think there was any other company at the time that grew so quickly and organically. Can you talk about kind of that element surprise even for you?
Yeah, it was very rapid. We had about 1 million people sign up in the first 3 months, and every day was kind of a new record. And we'd look at each other like, "Is this the day where we stop growing? Or is this something that's going to last?" If I, like, in my moments of going back to seeing articles from us and launch, and the comment section of all of those is full of people being like, "Oh, it'll be gone in a month. This is just like some like very like quick fad." But we saw that people would keep coming back.
You know, it was striking to, you know, Facebook, your acquirer, because they at the time were trying to build their own mobile app with photos, but theirs was kind of kludgy or complicated because they started out on the web. Can you talk about some of the early conversations that you and Kevin had with Mark, the founder?
I think what he was really interested in early on was how we focused so much on that one piece of content type, which was photos, that it actually changed the behavior and the dynamic of the network. So something that Facebook has always had is this variety of things, like there are text updates and photos and events, and but it was also very nice to have the intentionality of a feed that is photo first. And I think it drew Mark to realize how engaging that was, that people were coming back every day, that they were producing content for Instagram and coming there more and more to find out what their friends were up to.
You've really had a charmed existence. Like, was there anything that was harder for you than you thought?
All of the scaling part was really hard. I mean, and I think there's a way of talking about it without getting too technical, but...
Yeah, I mean, because your experience is the coding and the engineering, and we all take that for granted.
We were able to keep the site up for a lot of our early few years, mostly because a lot of good technology had been created like right before we came out. And it actually made it hard to recruit engineers because they would be like, what am I going to do? Like, everything is just working and your product looks done. And one of the hardest things is convincing people. It sounds like it's easy, but it's actually really hard to pitch their trailer to your wagon or whatever and like take that crazy ride with you. And we had a lot of trouble in the early days. There's a Quora thread on like, did you ever turn down a job at Instagram? And there's all these people that legitimately were like, hey, come join. And they're like, I don't know, it's just photos.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mike Krieger, co-founder of Instagram. We'll hear more from Mike coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mike Krieger, co-founder of the photo sharing app Instagram. Instagram was released through Apple's App Store in October 2010 and reached 1 million users in just 3 months. Facebook acquired Instagram in 2012 for $1 billion. Mike and his partner Kevin Systrom are both graduates of Stanford University. I want to talk about raising capital for a moment. Kevin had started with the company Bourbon, and his initial investors included Andreessen Horowitz. When you and he decided to switch to Instagram, you kind of had a hiccup moment with them because they were funding a competitor of Instagram, or what looked to be a competitor, PicPlease. And maybe the communication wasn't the best, but they chose to invest in PicPlease versus Instagram. Can you talk about that moment?
At the time, it felt like, oh my God, like, why didn't they choose us? Like, mm-hmm. At the time, it was just me and Kevin, basically. There was no other team. It's I think, pretty easy to think, oh, it's the world against us, which is actually pretty helpful, I think, in building your company because it gives you that real sense of purpose. I think this was chalked that one up, I think, to communication that could have gone better.
They wear a moral cloak when saying, well, we had to go with them. But they could have also gone with you since their investment in you was before the other company's investment. And they could have easily said that to the other company. So my view of the situation was that they just thought the other company would be more successful. Sorry.
You could say, I mean, we're two guys, you know, with no track record trying to get this thing off the ground. And, you know, we... Yeah, there were early signs that I think were really promising, like people were really taking up and starting to use Instagram, but it's so hard to predict. I mean, again, like you go back and the amount of probably somewhat healthy skepticism early on was really strong.
When I first learned about Instagram, I was like, oh, yeah, this is just Twitter with photos. You know, I want to talk about Twitter for a moment because Jack Dorsey was a former boss, like a mentor of sorts almost to Kevin. And he offered to buy Instagram. And, you know, Kevin and you ultimately decided to, you know, raise venture capital instead. Can you talk to us about that cobweb of conversations in that, you know, 3-month period? It wasn't even 3 months. But
it was really rapid. We were also building and launching our Android app. So me living on the engineering side, that was, you know, I was looking at the fundraising as something we just had to get done to move on to the next step and keep going. Meanwhile, focusing on launching our biggest launch ever, which was going to this new platform that literally every time I stood up in front of an audience, somebody would raise their hand and be like, when's the Android app coming? Imagine me pretty sleep deprived with a team of two other engineers working on Android. And Kevin, meanwhile, was fundraising. So there was, you know, not a lot of sleep, but we were just trying to like get the company ready for the next phase of growth. And what resonated ultimately about Facebook is we'd get to grow this thing independently.
And also, not that this was the reason for your decision, but Jack had offered to Kevin roughly $500 million, not in cash. Then you raise venture capital, which valued the company at $500 million. And 2 minutes later, Facebook buys you for double that. So there was, you know, that valuation component as well, which, of course, I don't blame you for.
Right, for sure. There's a lot of factors that go into that, right? There's definitely a moment where you have to say, all right, we have to seriously consider this and then think about what the trade-offs would be in terms of control and the future and all those different elements, for sure.
I was struck how you still raised that venture round, even though a week later you sold it to Facebook. What was your psychology around that?
I think ultimately it was realizing that the Valley is a very small place. And while I'm sure we could have found some way of backing out of the round that we were raising, I mean, the money wasn't in the bank yet. You know, life is long and the Valley is a small place. And it meant more that we were kind of true to our word than trying to like maximize in the short term there.
People talk today, oh, do you wish that, you know, you waited and sold the company for 20 times, you know, what you sold it for. But I mean, is that the way you want to live?
Yeah. I read a lot of science fiction. So like time travel and like the impossibility of realizing what one event has to do with the future is something I think a lot about. And you know, so much of our growth came from having the resources of saying, hey, our engineering team is 6 people. It really should be about 60 people yesterday. So let's, you know, hire in from Facebook. Let's take some of their best folks and move them over. And that was so key because we had struggled for years to actually hire out a team as quickly as we needed to.
You're now a company of over 200 people, but, you know, when you sold to Facebook, you were only 13 of you. And before that, there was just the two of you. Like, can you talk about what that dynamic was like when it was just the two of you?
It's interesting in the early days because you don't have data to make your decision. You're just sitting next to somebody and you kind of have to trust that you're making the right decision and run ahead. A phrase that we used that we learned actually in the Mayfield Fellows Program was, you may not be right, but at least don't be confused. So the worst thing, the thing that will sink you is indecision. And even when we like made the change and said like, we are ditching bourbon and we are doing Instagram, my suggestion was like, Kevin, why don't I work on that one and you work on the photos one and we can come back in a week and show what we learned. And he's like, no, like we may not be right, but let's not be confused. Like we got to focus on one thing. And I appreciate he said that because it's true, but there's no way you're going to be able to put a number on, you know, is this the right decision until much, much, much later.
This might seem like a distasteful question, but, you know, here you are, a 20-something kid who seems to have come from, you know, like an upper middle class background. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you have earned hundreds of millions of dollars for yourself. That's a stark change, that it's like a bomb went off in a good way. How do you navigate the psychology of that?
Yeah, I think it's been a few phases. It's overwhelming and crazy and like a little hard to grok from any kind of, you know, real like holistic view. But the first year was not doing anything differently at all. And then I think incorporating the changes that you want to incorporate your life kind of slowly. For Caitlin and I, it's like we love to travel. So getting to go to Iceland and seeing the crazy landscapes of Iceland was like really transformative and really special. But it's a cliche, but it really, I don't think money can really change you as much as just amplify the things that are kind of in you. And in our case, I think that's meant travel, getting really interested in philanthropy and trying to understand what that role plays, the role that plays in our life. For other people, it's, you know, I'm not going to judge, but like very different decisions that they might make.
Certainly, you had a fast and furious existence for, you know, a year and a half between when you launched on Apple's App Store to being acquired by Facebook. But I want to talk about your personal life during this period as well, because that was also kind of fast and furious. You met your now wife, Caitlin Trigger. How did you meet?
We met at a housewarming party. We had kind of seen each other before, but this time we actually struck up a conversation and bonded over our shared love of the band Beirut. And I taught her half of the song Postcards from Italy on the ukulele, and I promised to teach her the other half if she'd go on a date with me, which I've talked to friends since then, and we have come to the conclusion, and there's probably some evolutionary reason, that we were universally not people who were particularly, like, amazing at flirting or, you know, but there was a moment of inspiration, a really critical moment in our lives when we met our significant other. So that was my lightning moment. And it would have been very difficult to get through that year and a half without that kind of support, because very quickly, you know, people talk about building startup being hard work, and it is, but it's until you launch, it's hard work that you're in control over. But everything changes when you launch, especially when you have success or you gain traction, because all of a sudden your schedule is entirely dependent on what's happening out in the world. We would wake up every morning at 3 a.m. because that's when Japan would start using Instagram. And we were big in Japan in our first month. And all our phone alerts would start going off because the site was too slow. Boom, straight out of bed. To this day, I can't actually listen to the tritone ring on iPhone without having like a stress reaction, because that would wake me up middle of the night, jump on a laptop, you know, Skype with Kevin and try to fix the site.
You allude to Caitlin's support through this period. It's interesting. Caitlin spent a lot of her time growing up in China because her father was a guitar player, worked for the State Department teaching the Chinese students guitar. And so it was just so elegant that you happened to woo her with a guitar.
Exactly. There's definitely a connection. I think music has run through her family for sure.
You mentioned Japan before as being this important tastemaker in a way. And it occurred to me that Japan's design aesthetic is very simple. And I wonder if the simplicity of the app kind of resonated with the Japanese.
I think there was a couple of things. One was we built the app from day one to not require a lot of language to use. So we tried not to use button labels. We tried to use icons when possible. We tried to make the design self-explanatory. And I think what worked was they were looking for something to let them share their lives in a way that they felt a lot of control over. The privacy model of Instagram is very easy to understand, but so much fun to see all of a sudden all these photos from Japan come in. And a very, very early person joined. His name was Koji. He actually helped us translate into Japanese. And I remember when the earthquake happened, he was able to share his life about what was going on. And there's this connection with this person I've never, ever met, but he's over in Japan and living his life. And there's some really intense connection there.
Were there other kind of key people or events that really caused an escalation in penetration or in users?
I think the biggest one is very much the Android launch. And I think I see that as the turning point where we went from something that was iPhone only, US specific, to something that could truly be international. You know, over 65% of people use Instagram from outside the US now, which is creates a bunch of interesting challenges too, right? Like, how do you make sure that your app is working well in Brazil? Well, I can go visit home, but, you know, in Scandinavia, in Japan, in Russia, all these different places.
Do you notice a difference in the type or quality of pictures that people might take from country to country? Like, what are some cultural characteristics,
We love looking at that. I remember when we finally had a data team for the first time, we're like, what does this look like if you cut it by country? And some of them are pretty expected, like Brazilians have a much higher selfie percentage and a lot more photos of folks with each other, which I think just I'll ascribe to our general, like, social, you know, happiness. Definitely a lot more landscapes in Europe that we found. Japan has probably, and this is not a statistically significant change, but purely anecdotal, but like a higher prevalence of pet accounts. So the most famous hedgehog on Instagram was in Japan.
What about New Yorkers?
New Yorkers. It's a good question about New Yorkers. I was actually just watching a highlight reel, like, what are some recent videos taken in New York? And what I like is the collision between the tourism and then the folks who live here. So it's a mixture of, hey, like, I'm at CrossFit because that's what I do every morning, to, oh my God, the Empire State Building.
How about your Instagram account?
It's definitely changed. I was looking through my early Instagram photos, and there's sort of this change of just being more visible. And I think that definitely leads to some self-editing for sure, whereas back then I was like, oh, here's my apartment, here's my dog, here's my then-girlfriend, here are my parents. And now I'm like, oh, like, there's just more visibility, and I think I'm a lot more careful about what I share. But recently I've been playing around with – I have a second account, a secret account, and that's been a fun one where I can take – kind of like ugly photos, but they're ugly photos that represent some kind of like behind the scenes, and you know, my family and Caitlin and Kevin can comment on those.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mike Krieger, co-founder of Instagram, the photo sharing app acquired by Facebook in 2012. You are from Brazil. Where are your ancestors from?
So my dad's side came from Poland, and my mom's side came from Italy.
How would your parents describe you?
Oh, interesting. I think I was an intense kid. I think I loved reading. Didn't have a ton of friends. Had a few very intense friendships. Would spend my afternoons, you know, nerding out, reading, spending a lot of time on the computer. My dad brought a computer home when I was 5 or 6 years old. And since then, there's probably not been a day. It's maybe a sad admission that I haven't spent at least a couple hours, you know, messing around with stuff.
You know, you talk about being glued to the computer since you were 5 or 6. During high school, you worked on a computer project teaching employees from your high school, actually, the maintenance workers. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, there was a community service requirement at my school. And the project I chose was one where you would stay after school and help the maintenance workers at the school and the kitchen staff, whoever wanted to sign up, to use a computer. And I had so many experiences of bringing people online for the first time, having them sign up for an email account, trying to explain to people what a CAPTCHA is, right? They've barely seen it. A CAPTCHA is that little, like, they type in, like, some letters that are kind of scrambled up to prove that you're a human and not a robot. How do you explain to them that not only are they online, but also spammers are online, and we have to defend against spammers, and so we have to make their life more inconvenient? A lot of concepts that I took for granted growing up, you know, with computing from a very early age were very difficult for newcomers to understand.
You, in a way, because you've been so focused on the screen your whole life, how do you think that's informed the way you deal with the world? I ask that question because, you know, I have young children, and I'm always like, no screen time, right? You want their experience to be as 3D as possible. Like, what are your thoughts on navigating the two-dimensionality of sitting in front of a computer screen versus just being out there?
You know, I've had a lot of conversations with Caitlin already, like, how much screen time do our eventual kids have? You know, what time do they get a cell phone? I guess I got to see the most positive version of it, which is, you know, I grew up liking music that was pretty weird by, like, my high school standards. I liked Belle and Sebastian and the Smiths, and, like, nobody, like, Brazil probably had, like, 10,000 Belle and Sebastian fans across the whole country at the time. And being online as much as I was meant that I could connect with, like, random people in Scotland that, like, grew up with Stuart Murdoch. So I guess I got to see the most positive version of it, of really getting to connect with people based on interests, which I hope Instagram lets you do as well. You know, like, mm-hmm. if you're really into knitting or floral design, or in my case, Bernese Mountain Dogs, there is a community out there for you. Mm-hmm. And I found that community very early, you know, through mailing lists and Usenet and, you know, all the different technologies from that time.
What do your parents do?
My dad works, or worked, he just retired, but worked for a long time in the distilled drinks industry. So he worked at Seagram's and Diageo, and most recently Beam. They make Jim Beam. It gave me the opportunity to live in Brazil and Portugal and Argentina growing up.
And how about your mom?
She worked in advertising when I was growing up, and now she does landscape design.
Landscape design, part of the attractiveness for people about Instagram is its stripped down nature. Do you have, like, an affinity towards, like, Danish design?
My mom has a very strong sense of design, so our house, I always grew up kind of with, like, a nicely laid out interiors that are both Brazilian but also have that kind of modern feel as well. But it's definitely what I'm most drawn to. I took an amazing design history class at Stanford, and the Bauhaus, that phase of design was the part that I was most drawn to, just very simple, elegant, minimal, rather than very ornate.
What's something I might not know about you?
Let's see, I'm a musician, although I don't play nearly as often as I'd like to today. Oh, I used to like make short films in high school, and that was fun and difficult, and one of the first times I've ever like thrown myself into something where it requires that like extra 20 hours to really make great. Like, you can get it to work and you can have all the raw footage you want, but if it's not edited correctly, then you might as well not have it.
What's an example of a short film that you made in high school?
I really enjoyed making short films about the school itself. So I would do programs on the kitchen staff or the maintenance department and see how they work day to day. And they were kind of in a little bit of gonzo journalism style. I had a friend, Mike Cole, and we would, you know, stick him in the kitchen to cook for a day or like have him try to use the buzzsaw and, you know, but as a way of just showing what's going on behind the school, you know, lines.
What was the last book you read?
Ooh, I read a lot of books. I'm finally reading Creativity, Inc., which is like the Pixar book. It's actually really interesting for me. I feel like I'm going through a similar process as Ed Catmull talks about in his book, where you're no longer trying to like build this thing to, you know, achieve some user number. You're really starting to think of it as building the company that will sustain itself for a really long time. And that's actually a similar transition for both me and Kevin, where, you know, I'm not doing engineering day in day to day, although yesterday we had a hack day, so I actually got to code for the first time in like a year. But I'm thinking about how the organization builds, and I no longer have to be in every decision or every review.
What other book have you read?
So the other thing I'm reading, there's a British author named Nick Harkaway, who I love. He writes science fiction, but does so with a really good sense of humor. So I'm reading a book called Angel Maker right now. I just read All the Light We Cannot See, which I thought was really good.
I did too. Why did you like it?
All the Light We Cannot See, I like the like mixture of like the tinkerer with the historical overlay, which I feel somehow connected to, having like family origins in Europe and having folks have left right during that that time of the century.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Absolutely.
My guest has been Mike Krieger, co-founder of Instagram. Coming up, we'll meet Emily Weiss, founder of Glossier. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Emily Weiss, founder of the online beauty products company Glossier. Emily launched Glossier's first line of skin products in 2014. In 2010, she founded Into the Gloss, an online community dedicated to beauty. Visitors get tips on skin, hair, makeup, and learn the beauty routines of leading members of the cosmetic and fashion industries. Prior to starting Glossier and Into the Gloss, Emily was a fashion assistant at Vogue and W magazines. Welcome.
Thank you. You know everything about me.
Is that all there
is? That's it. We can stop.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
How would you describe what Into the Gloss is?
The reason for being for Into the Gloss is really that as a, in the time I was a 25-year-old, style-minded, you know, very enthusiastic consumer of beauty and fashion. And I'd always loved beauty products, but I really didn't know where to look except going to a store to talk to someone who I'd never met before to give me advice. I thought that seemed kind of silly. So what I wanted to do was interview all my heroes. You said this interview will be an hour, and I was like, oh, no problem. I do this all the time. I sit on floors of women's bathrooms, from Arianna Huffington to Alexa Chung to, you know, Selena Gomez and Isabel Marant, and ask them about their approach to beauty. Mm. And that's not a simple question. The idea was really to bring beauty to the internet in a meaningful way.
Where does the conversation go beyond what is my beauty regimen?
Oh, all over. If you think about it, your relationship to beauty begins at a very young age, from watching your mother, from what she does, from not being allowed to use certain things, and then, you know, having to go out on your own, you know, from learning how to shave your legs to cutting yourself open to, you know, crazy eyebrow trauma suffered in teen years, tadpole brows. So it's not just the kind of Us Weekly, what's in your bag. It's not just what you're currently doing. It's everything that's gotten you there.
One's relationship with beauty, it's such a personal and complex relationship. Yet there were so few places that you could go to where people were talking about just that mm-hmm. in 2010. And it's striking how, you know, fashion is much more public, right? Mm-hmm. Fashion has been pervasive. It's in every magazine. And it's sort of like beauty's coat.
Yeah, I think I like to say that's a really insightful comment because even from the beginning of Into the Gloss, I was kind of mad. I started to understand that beauty is almost like this kid's sister, this ugly stepsister to fashion. Like the clothes come first, it's all about the outfit, it's all about the shoes, and then you figure out your face and your hair kind of after.
Ironically, because that's probably, you know, what's most personal and important to every person.
Right. Ironically, it's like really this... I mean, who isn't tormented by their hair, right? You're always figuring out what to do with it. So I think it is, I often in my life found that I started with beauty. Even just, you know, anecdotally, like changing my hair from brown to platinum blonde a couple of years ago, I was like a whole different person. People mm-hmm. didn't recognize me. And then I started dressing in an entirely different way.
We started this interview with a sound check where I asked, you know, what did you eat this morning? And you said, you know, you're on a cleanse and mm-hmm. you're eating these shakes with almond butter and what else?
So many things. Flaxseed oil, coconut oil, almond milk.
The reason I mention it is, you know, it's sort of like the gas in your gas tank that helps to bring the beauty to
totally.
The surface. It's all about the self in a way.
Yes.
And I think of Maslow's like hierarchy of needs. We have warmth and food and, you know, so next comes like self-actualization.
Thank you.
As part of all that, right?
I can't believe you're saying this because this is actually what I've been kind of banging on about is in the beauty industry, it's been founded on, I mean, you're talking about a $250 billion global industry. It's a storied industry with heritage brands like Estee Lauder and Helena Rubinstein and Elizabeth Arden who have, you know, were built 50 years ago and 60 years ago when technology was totally different, when communications and media were completely different, mm-hmm. and when women were completely different. And I think, you know, when those women created these really pioneering companies, they were addressing the needs of women at that time. And I think a big message that happened was very much about glamour, very much about fantasy, very much about a homogenous sort of image of perfect and white picket fence and husband and lady of leisure and, you know, blonde kids running around with a Labrador and Palm Beach and, you know, this sort of high life. And I think right now, I mean, it just couldn't be more different for the most part in terms of what women aspire to. Mm. And I think what women aspire to now is self-actualization, and that has replaced this sex sells fantasy. Mm. So it's not sex sells. I actually think it's self sells. I mean, most of my friends, at least, I can't speak for all women. When I think about what I aspire to, it's to be the best version of yourself, but you don't aspire to clone, you know, Eva Longoria on the red carpet. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that's not the ticket to a happier me.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Emily Weiss, founder of Glossier, a digital direct-to-consumer beauty products company. She's also the founder of Into the Gloss, a website focused on beauty that she launched in 2010. Going back to the early days, when you were starting your blog, mm-hmm. You were working full-time at Vogue for Elisa Santisi, the mm-hmm. style director. You would work on your blog when?
Yeah, that's, I thank God I did that when I was like 25 because I would not be able to do that now because it took a lot of stamina. But I would transcribe interviews from, you know, 4 in the morning till 8 and then put up and write and edit whatever photos or, you know, interviews and then go to work by 9:30. And then I would typically shoot the features, you know, upcoming features on the weekends.
And Sally Singer, the Vogue editor.
Vogue.com.
Vogue.com. Mm-hmm. She was your first top shelf
yep.
feature. Top shelf is on your site. You interview people about their beauty regimen. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
That was just amazing because I admired Sally. I mean, really, it was an opportunity at 25 to be in a room and actually have FaceTime with these women who I just so admired. And,
not just any room. You're in
their
bathroom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and you're kind of disarmed. You're seeing something unsavory, no matter what. There's always like something weird. There's like a weird toothbrush that's frayed, and you're like, damn, I wish I would have thrown that out. You know, like you're in it together.
Have you ever done a top shelf interview where you've been surprised by what people's beauty routine is? I don't know. What are some unlikely finds?
I'm always interested in people's aversion or inclusion of plastic surgery. So I'm always really, you know, I always kind of ask. Sometimes I really ask if we're having a certain rapport, you know, I'm like, hey, do you ever get anything done? Do you ever get like, especially women of a certain age, you know, like, you're like, so how do you look so good? You know, tell me. And so it's always interesting to me who kind of fesses up and who doesn't. I have no judgment either way. Some people just are very casual and are like, yeah, I get Botox. I go to this doctor. I go every 6 months. It's great. And other women are like, oh, no, I would never. But you know what? That's personal information. So it's whatever you want.
I want to talk about your background. You grew up in Wilton, Connecticut, although you lived in the South also because your father worked for Pitney Bowes.
Yes.
Now, Pitney Bowes, they put the stamping meter on mail,
Postage meter. Yep.
So can you tell me more about your dad's job and your view of his job?
Sure. So the first thing I can tell you about my dad's job is never think that that's a fun game to play, just running pieces of paper through the postage meter to make cool designs, because actually you're printing money.
Because you had a Pitney Bowes machine in your house?
We did, yes. We had a Pitney Bowes machine in the basement, a postage meter.
And your mom is a homemaker.
Yes. And my dad's job, I mean, what I've learned from my dad and how I viewed my dad is he is the American dream. I mean, he is from a, you know, middle-class family in Ohio, didn't graduate college. He started working as a door-to-door salesman of Pitney Bowes products in his early 20s. He used to hand stamp his business cards. Funnily enough, he made my own first Into the Gloss cards with me. We did these little nail polish drops on every card. So each card was different, had a different color. And he ended up rising through the ranks to become president of Pitney Bowes. I learned a ton about, you know, perseverance and patience and hard work. There's probably not really many people out there who could say that I'm not extremely hardworking. Even with Into the Gloss, I spent, I think, $750 of my own money to, invest, quote unquote, in the building of Into the Gloss as a blog, and bought a camera for $500, and, you know, that was it.
What about your mom? Every woman in her moments has some communication with
her daughter.
Yeah, with her daughter, or even unspoken. Like, what did that look like?
I mean, I was very self-motivated by style and beauty. People often say, oh, you know, where did it come from? And it really didn't come from family. I think it came from media and from magazines like Vogue and from movies like Clueless and being in the mall. And I just loved it. And my mom just supported it and was really like, you know, you look crazy, but if you really want to go to school like that with like over the knee stockings, then like you can, but you're 12. So know that that's unusual. And I would say, I know, I'm going to go anyway and get made fun of.
And then what about her? Like, what are images? You know, I think of my mom. She had those curlers. You know, putting curlers hair.
My mom's pretty, like, wash and go. Her hair, we have the same hair. It's straight, sticks straight. It's brown.
Were you judgy? Did you judge her when you were going through your...
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I mean, no. I would just be like, let's go shopping for me.
You wrote letters to Vogue when you were like 10 years old?
I don't know how old I was, but one was published and it was a reaction to a Arthur Elgort short skirt story. Arthur Elgort's this like fabulous photographer. And I remember writing this letter, editor's letter to Vogue and saying, you know, I really appreciate as a young woman your portrayal of mini skirts as like something that can be very classy and done tastefully and like done well and like bravo. And they published it. I mean, it's not like that big of a deal, but imagine you're like flipping through your new issue as like a 14-year-old and you see your name and it says Emily Weiss, Wilton, Connecticut. I'm like, I'm famous. This is awesome.
Now, what were some defining moments in your path towards what you're doing now that, you know, you look back on in retrospect?
Well, I would say the biggest, you know, moment for me and Mark, especially in my professional career, was my work with Elisa Santisi when I was, 23 to 25. I mean, I was a really precocious, I was a pain in the ass, like for sure, because I'm super ambitious. I'm really precocious. I have no filter. I say what's on my mind. I'm probably like the worst assistant, but she was so patient with me and we had so much fun. I learned so much from her that I would say it was really the first time in my life I had really worked so closely with another individual. Mm. Like, I'm usually a real loner, and it was really the first time I thought, oh, you know what? I really like teamwork. and I think that was a big moment.
Now, did you know when you were launching this blog that, yes, I want to convert this into something much larger, or did that kind of happen accidentally?
No, I knew it would be successful, but I didn't know what success meant, if that makes sense. So I was an art major at NYU. I never took a business course. And then I figured it out because it was like, oh, I get it. You have, if you are a media company, you make money through advertising. So let's get some advertising, you know.
And that's where Carrie Diamond comes
exactly.
in.
Exactly.
So who's Carrie Diamond and how was she helpful?
So I told two people about Into the Gloss. Of course, I told my boss and I said, I'm starting this blog and is that okay? And she said, sure. And the other person who I went to was Eva Chen. She heads up fashion at Instagram, but at the time she was the beauty director of Teen Vogue. And I had never actually worked with Eva, but I asked, hey, can I come talk to you about this crazy idea I have? She said, this is great. You absolutely need to do this, and you need to go meet Carrie Diamond. Carrie is this visionary at Lancôme, the beauty company. I hounded Carrie Diamond. I wrote her all these emails. She's like, who is this person? And finally, I called her one day, and she answered, and I was like, I gotcha. Like, hey, it's me. And she's like, what? And I'm like, hey, can I just come? I'll come anytime. She was like, can you be here in 20 minutes? I said, no problem. So I went to her office at Lancôme, and I showed her my little sketch of how the website would look, because it wasn't up yet. And she said, this is great. Have you talked to any other brands? And I said, no, I don't even know what I'm talking about. What are we talking about? And she said, good. I'm going to give you, I think it was like $2,000 or $5,000 or something. She was like, I'm going to give you $5,000 and I want an exclusive for 6 months on like all your banner ads. And I was like, great. I don't know what a banner ad is, but like we'll build it. Mm-hmm. And thank you. It was great. It was like, hey, I have the, you know, ears of at least one person at this very, very big company who believes that we're onto something.
I want to talk about raising capital for a moment. Investors include Kirsten Green's Forerunner Ventures, mm-hmm. the entrepreneur Andy Dunn, who founded Bonobos, Josh Kushner's fund Thrive mm-hmm. Capital, the venture capital fund founded by the founder of The Gap, Bill Fisher. Talk to me about that process. And what is it that you told them you wanted to build?
The most influential beauty company of our generation. Kirsten Green, you know, is really someone to note here because venture capital is a highly male-dominated industry, as is the tech industry, as is the startup industry. And Kirsten's fund, it's noteworthy, is all females. She has, I think it's like four women who work with her.
So despite the dearth or the scarcity of women, both at venture firms, but also, you know, starting companies, like what pushback did you face?
I think in life in general, we as humans go off a lot of familiarity and a lot of pattern recognition. And when you're thinking about a room full of men meeting someone like me, coming in and talking to them about something they know nothing about, it's a much harder sell. Mm-hmm. You need to then support it with a ton of data. You need to support it with a ton of numbers. It needs to be really understandable why your mascara is better than the mascara down the street, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's something that I don't expect a table full of men to know as well as if I had come in and started talking about, you know, Dropbox.
Did you explain?
Yeah, I explained. I tried to understand what would help them understand the beauty market. And walking through the drugstore and trying to pick out a lipstick out of a wall of 700 lipstick colors that you can't even test because they're wrapped in plastic is also hard. And going to Sephora and talking to someone who you've never met before who has no idea, you know, who you are is also not ideal. So being able to talk about, you know, the direct-to-consumer relationship that we want to build through our background as being really expert storytellers and expert communicate, you know, really being able to communicate on the channels that women are on, like Instagram, like Snapchat, like, you know, our website and through the comment section, and building a company where we really want to engage her, you mm-hmm. know, and actually really want her to help build it with us and tell us what she's into and us be able to respond to her rather than this kind of archaic way that a lot of brands just have in their DNA where they say, we know best, we're going to make something over here in a place that you can't see and you don't know us and we're going to throw it over the fence and then we hope you like it, you know, but we're not really going to talk about it with you is all a little bit like funky. That's a lot of the conversation we had.
building a cosmetics business is very different from building a blog. And so, you know, talk to me about like the chemistry of these products, because I'm kind of a skeptic. Like, I look at all this and I'm, first of all, overwhelmed. And I'm like, you know what? They all work the same. They all have water and, you know, X, Y, and Z, you know, in the first three ingredients. Mm-hmm. So talk to me about just like the raw chemistry behind how you went about it.
Absolutely. It's a great question. And it's one that many women have. The first thing that we did was hire an expert in-house who's product development, you know, done it for 10 years, and surrounded ourselves with various advisors, and also hired and contracted a independent chemist to work on developing with us, translating all of our ideas and our crazy, you know, ideas and our wants and our needs, kind of like an architect would with a home, and would say, okay, let me create this recipe for you.
And it's a democratic skin line for the Instagram generation, because the prices are accessible.
Yes. They're $12 to $28.
One fun part of all of this is that it comes in a bubble wrap bag that kind of has a pink tint, and that's kind of kid-like.
Yeah, because I think beauty should make you smile. Like, it shouldn't make you feel like, I can't afford this, or it shouldn't make you feel like, should I use this last drop of eye cream, because if I use this and I'm out, and maybe I'll just use this one on Sundays. It's like, no, you should be able to use this all the time, not sweat it. You can have everything that we make, our whole collection, for under, I think, $200 now. Right. You know, you're like a baller for having like everything.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Emily Weiss, founder of Glossier.
If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris, or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.